you have actually met before in previous talks and things like that. How many of you are new? First time I'm meeting today. How many of you are undecided? First of all, thanks for coming. I know that it's the final weeks of the semester. This is when all the procrastination, all the delay in the past, all the not revising stuff, not doing your assignments, the pressure is building up. And based on the meditation that I observe, the number of fishing meditation that's going on, it's very tiring time also for students and also for people who are working. It's heading at the end of the year. It's often when we kind of run out of steam, kind of crawling our way towards the end of the year. So I want to acknowledge you for coming and to spend time to develop yourself, to develop a better understanding of the Buddha's teachings, a better understanding for you to develop internally. And tonight's talk is how to be a half full cup. I'll try my best to fulfill that. This is a tough topic. It's given to me by Emily. Any complaints, go to her. She's the previous Dharma Talk coordinator. I think it was around this side in May that you asked me to do this topic. And for this topic, I have to search quite deeply into a specific set of the Buddha's teachings that's not often known. And these are part of the teachings that we call the esoteric practices. It's not the common type of Buddhism that we hear about, but it is a very kind of very unique and deep practice that trains the mind such that upon death, the life force of the mind gets pushed over to the next life and you reincarnate as a cup. I'm just joking. Sorry to disappoint some of you. As I was talking, some of you may be thinking, whoa, wrong room. But to come back to all seriousness, this is a very fascinating topic. When Emily first mentioned it, I was like, I'm going to teach people how to get rebirth as a cup. How to be a full cup, but not quite that. To give you a bit of background of where I'm coming from in this evening's talk, professionally, I'm a clinical psychologist, so I work with a lot of different people in different contexts with different difficulties, issues. My key areas, my specialty is in anxiety, and I see some people also with mood-associated disorders, depression, and also work a lot with people with loss, grief, and loss, death, dying, those type of processes. So this is something that I've developed across the years of seeing people, different people, in the most difficult times, suffering distress. But way before I became a psychologist, I was very interested in Buddhism and began intensive personal practice in Buddhism. And like you, I was sitting in one of those seats as a member of Unibuds many years back then. And when I was actually thinking about what to actually cover this evening, I thought in the past few talks, I've covered it a bit more from the psychology angle. But for this evening, probably it's important to start to weave both of them together and see how they interface. So in preparation for this talk, I did what any sensible person would do. I Googled how a few articles came out, nothing overly exciting. I thought, nah, I can't cheat. So I had to think a bit more deeply And these are reflections from my own personal practice. So this evening, I'm going to talk about three different pathways to think about how to be a half full cup. Is that right? Three parts. No, nothing to do with reincarnation. And this is not from Google either, right? Is it all right if I rub this part of this off? How to be a half full cup? The most basic stuff, part one. What do you need to be a half full cup?
Water.
Water. Cup.
Cup.
I don't have very good drawing skills. So first you need a cup. To be a half full cup, water is important, correct? But the cup comes first. As far as the cup is concerned, what does it mean as far as our Dharma practice? What does it mean by the cup that we have?
Restraint.
Self, different angles, both correct. I'm talking more about the former, this idea of restraint. When we talk about the cup itself, it needs to be able to hold. Diagrams for a while. Kind of okay. The cup actually means our precepts. The avoiding of doing things that harm you and or harm others. Why is this symbolized by the cup? Because if you have a cup that is cracked, see, even the big cup agrees. What happens when you put water in there? Leaks. Worst case, it breaks. So it is important for us to have good values that lead us to live a good life. The most basic foundational aspect in Buddhist training. And when I talk about this, I talk about Buddhist training because essentially the Buddhist path is a path of training. It is not a path of belief. It is not a path that you just have faith in. It is a path of actually training oneself, specifically one's mind, in certain qualities. And the most basic training, the entirety of the Buddha's path, the first step is laying the foundations for a good life, for a good wholesome life. And this is where the precepts come in. By precepts, I mean the guiding principles in how we interface with the world, how we interact with one another. And the Buddha gave us very clear guidelines, the five precepts. Abstain from taking life. Abstaining from taking that which is not yours. Abstaining from sexual misconduct. Abstaining from false speech. And abstaining from intoxications. Now, the way that the Buddha formulated precepts comes from the things that will bring you harm, reduce it. Abstain. Try to minimize that as much as you can in your day-to-day life. Because this provides a very good foundation building block for a more peaceful, better life. If you're not out taking life, not out stealing, you're not telling lies, naturally, your life is better. There's more a foundation of your life that allows a certain safety net, allows a certain grounding. So this is the most basic part. When I look at the cup itself, it actually is about our moral code, our values. Now, some of you here are not even Buddhists, I understand. But it's about living an ethical life. A lifestyle that is ethical, that does not bring any harm to you and or other people. If there's something that brings harm to you or other people, abstain from that. Avoiding that which is evil. That's kind of the traditional translation. Avoid all evil. This is the first part. And when you have that, then everything else can be built on top of it. The other practices, meditation, generosity, all those things can be put on top of it. But if not, if you do not have that most basic foundation, what you put in there will be leaking out. So that essentially is what protects us from difficulties, suffering. Is that how you draw it? No? Well, that's how I draw it. The fires of the world. This is what protects it. So by having good precepts, a good foundation, morality, we remove that. Then we are ready for the next step. The Buddha said, avoid all evil, do good. This is where the water comes in. And then, ta-da! Half full cup, half full beaker. That's all. Then you must be thinking, if it was just that simple, then why is the Buddha so great? The story doesn't end there. The plot thickens, as they would say. So the most basic part of the Buddha's teaching gives us a direction, a gradual process in how you cultivate things. It says that if you're coming to learn from me, and you want me to summarize all my teaching into something very, very simple, a few key simple principles. The first principle is avoid that which causes harm to you and others. Avoid all evil. And if you're able to do that, then do the second part. Do all good. Do all the things that are wholesome, that bring benefit to you and or other people. Do that which brings benefit to you. Do that which brings benefit to other people. And this is essentially how we allow goodness to flow into our lives. Where are we going to get the water from? If not by doing good, wholesome actions. And there are two parts to this. Doing that which is good to you. This is important. What are the things that nourish, that help us develop, that help us care for ourselves? Help us be close to reality. To live a good life that we can be at peace, at ease with ourselves. Those things, if you find out, do it. In fact, the Buddha was quite good in providing us guidelines but allowing a fair bit of flexibility depending on where his audience was. He'll say that you know and see for yourself what is good for you, do more of it. And that which is good for other people, cultivate that, develop that. And in his words, perfect that. So avoid evil, do good. This is the second part of his teaching. And when you're able to do that, then the water keeps adding. Some of you may be thinking, if it continues adding, you don't even have a Dhamma. But let's say that if it is at a certain point in your life whereby you've done some good, you've got some pretty good foundation in the precepts, what else? Like I say, the story does not finish there. Part two.
Okay.
Do you know what that means? Someone lost an eye. Now this is a bit closer to what we conventionally think when we talk about how to be a half full cup. It's how do we allow ourselves to be in touch with what we have and not just being in touch with that. Right? When you traditionally think of half full cup, are you more half full cup type of person or you are more half empty type of person? Do you guys think of that question? How many of you are more half full type of a person? How many of you are more half empty type of person? How many of you are asleep? There's research in science, in psychology, that says that those of people, whereby in their life situation, that they're able to focus more on the good things that are going on, they're generally happier. Now you may be interested. And the same research also says that the people who are here are naturally what we call more optimists. Whereas the people who are focusing here are naturally more pessimist. They tend to be less happy. But they tend to be closer to reality. So are you saying that those who are closer to, who are more pessimists, are closer to reality, but that makes them upset? That's what the research says. Not me. But those who are able to focus on the good things in your life are naturally happier, but may not be as in touch with reality. Tricky, isn't it? So should I be more here? Or should I be more here? Let's work on it bit by bit, right? It's alright, we still have time. We'll leave you half hanging. It is important for us to focus on this part for some reasons. That it generates some level of lightness in our hearts, in our minds, and it also generates energy for us to do the things and kind of interact in life. You know yourself, when you are focused or you when you are noticing the goodness in your life, the things that are going well, the things that are good, that are wholesome, things that are happening well, naturally you feel lighter. You think of the things that are not going well, the difficult assignment, the fail marks, the later, whatever it is, relationship loss, conflict, whatever it is, naturally your mood goes down. Right? That's just reality. You focus on one thing happens. You focus on another thing happens. But in Buddhism, we talk about the importance of this as well. And this is encapsulated in the teaching where the Buddha said, there are two kinds of people who are hard to find in the world. This is from the scripture, Anguttara Nikaya. There are two kinds of people hard to find in the world. The first, to do kindness, and those who are grateful and thankful for kindness done. There are two kinds of people who are hard to find. The first, to do kindness. And those who are thankful and grateful to the kindness that has been done by you and by others. When you look into your life, the things that are going well always comes from certain kindness. It may not naturally seem like kindness, but it's due to the giving, the generosity of others. You don't live in a vacuum. Anything that's going well is because other people has contributed something in it. Time, effort, love, care, even just being responsible, doing what they need to be doing, those things allow your life to go well. So, when the Buddha says, or the Buddha's equivalent to focusing on this part is the practice of gratitude. And this is really important because this often gets dropped off when we speak about Buddhism. It's not very often spoken about. More so in the Mahayana tradition. They have more practices around that. But these days when we talk about meditation and things like that, sometimes the gratitude part gets dropped off. And it's important for us to know that this particular teaching, this particular practice, helps us lift the mind. When you're able to tune into the things that you're thankful for, there's a shift in the energy in your mind. Just close your eyes for a few moments. Close your eyes. Bring to mind a few things that you're grateful for today. Just today. Don't need to look far. Bring to mind the things you're grateful for today. Something simple, something big. As you have these things in your mind, think of all the people that have contributed to that happening. Open your eyes. Apart from those of you who may have fallen asleep in the process, how does it feel? How did I feel? Hard to do? How many of you found that hard to do? It's alright. I find it hard to do, to be honest. It's just how the mind is. I had to practice that when I first started. How many of you found it quite easy? Okay, good. These are practitioners. But you did that. Do you notice any shift in your mind? Spacious? What else? Warm? Happier? Sometimes there is a sense of like something being stirred, but you don't quite know what it is. It's like something is moving, is stirring. Any of you have that? Yep. You can't quite pinpoint what it is, but there's the stirring. That's the kind of the force, the kind of energy in you being activated. And that's just today. If we had time to actually deepen this exercise into the last week, the last month, the last year, and we look back at your lifetime, each day, there'll be about three things that you're quite easily thankful for. And you look back in your week, there'll be about three things in your week that you're grateful for. And you look back in the month, there'll be three things in the month that you're kind of grateful for. You look back in the year, there are about three things that stand out of all the many things. Out of your entire life, there'll be a few things. And these are your batteries that you can charge as you go. And the more that you are in touch and connect with that, the easier it becomes. Then you start seeing the things left, right, center. To be honest, when I started, my personality is such that I'm not that good in this practice to begin with. Gratitude. It took me a few years to work on it. You know, I tend to be the type that's kind of grumpier by nature. Years of practice, softening the mind, softening the heart, opening, lightening. Right? And then you see yourself change through time too. Then you can see, wow, beautiful sunset. Maybe not yesterday. But yeah, naturally, you're more in tune with different things. Right? The things that are going well. Oh, beautiful weather, oh, something that's happened, oh, wonderful food, oh, an opportunity to do this, to do that.
it becomes a habit that keeps opening up, keeps opening up, keeps opening up. It's really like a flower that blooms. Initially, the soil of the heart may be so dry that you put a little gratitude there, the air disappears. Drop down. Right, I need to do more. Okay, starting to catch a bit. And then you focus on the gratitude part, it blooms, continues to unfold. To the point whereby you can be grateful for the difficulties in your life. When you're able to do that, you know that your practice has gained a certain momentum. It's easier to be grateful for, wow, wonderful weather. But when it's stormy and you need to go out, there's a picnic planned, at that moment, can you still find the thankfulness in it? And if you're able to, you know that it's reached a certain momentum. Keep going. That's powerful stuff that you have. So the practice of gratitude, that's the most basic part in terms of this. So if I wanted to cheat, I could just come in and say, how to be a half full cup? Be grateful. Ta-da! And then I'll get an email from Emily or Alan. A bit short, your talk. So to pad it out a bit. Nah, just joking. This is just one of many things, many tools that the Buddha has given us. Right? But you have to see that where the foundation needs to build from. If you're just being grateful, but you're living your life in such a way that's not ethical and not continuing to bring goodness into your life, it's kind of hard to do this part. Right? You're going around harming yourself, harming others, and you've got a bank account with zero balance in it, and you're kind of overdrawn by a lot, and you've got fire burning everywhere, and then I say, be grateful. You want to strangle me, right? So you see how it is a systematic practice. You need the most basic moral code. You do good, invite goodness into your life, into you, into others, and then focus on the gratitude part. Then you're on to something. Then you have a workable system that is integrated. Right? If not, you're going like a car with one wheel. Can it move? Technically, you can. Right? You just kind of have to drag it along, but not a great car. But now you've got one wheel, two wheels, three wheels. Great. Now we're talking. Right? But then there's more. Feels like I'm selling a package. Wait! If you ring now... Now, two eyes. What does it mean?
Acknowledging the other side.
Acknowledging the other side. Remember how I said that in science, when we study people with optimist or pessimist type of viewpoints, that this one is happier, this one is more depressed, but this one is more in touch with reality. This one is slightly a bit off sometimes. It may have an overly kind of optimistic view. He's like, it looks like all the dark clouds. It's like, yeah, it'd be fine. Don't need my umbrella. Maybe they have great gratitude. Wow. No, <I don't> know. But this, if anything at all, do this. But if possible, develop further, this part. Both eyes wide open. What does it mean? You're fully in touch with what is working, what is good in your life, but at the same time, you're fully aware of what are the things that are not going as well, what are the things that need to be developed, what are the things that need to continue to be perfected. So you're not kidding or fooling yourself that everything is just rosy when it's not.
I don't mean rosy. Everything is nice and great when it's not. You are aware that there are things that are beautiful, that are going well, but you're also aware of the things that are not so great. In fact, the most recent research, a piece of research from, I think, Taiwan National University, is that they took this piece of research about optimists and pessimists, and they developed it further. They wanted to know, how about people within the optimist group? Are there people who are optimists but yet quite realistic? Because not all optimists are kind of very, like, oh, you know, everything will be fine. It's not like that. But they noticed that some people within this category, in fact, do really well. They're very successful. They're very on the ball. They're very focused. They know what they have to do. So they went and studied this group of people. And they found that within this group, there are two types of optimists. One type of optimist is what they call, just to make sure I get the right label, realist optimists. And the other group is what they call unrealistic optimists, or wildly optimist, or in my words, a bit gone off the radar optimist. That we don't want. They found that people who are optimists and yet are realist, they're realistic about what's happening, those are the people that have the most success and greatest happiness in their life. Now, this is like the next level up. Like I say, if anything at all, start from gratitude. Once you get that, add in also, start to be aware of both sides of the coin. Because all Buddhism, the most important principle is satya. That's the word, satya. I don't mean the Hyunbun's newsletter, satya. I know that it's called satya. Satya means truth. The most basic principle of Buddhism is the invitation to see the true nature of things. So, if you're practicing gratitude, and you're also practicing truth, satya, you're at the same time being aware of the other side, the things that are not going as well, things that need still to be worked on. And this is in fact closer even to the deeper part of Buddhism. You're aware of what are the things that are going well, aware of the things that are not going so well. To see things realistically, this is the key part. So if you can do this, gratitude, right? If you tend to naturally be more focusing on things that are negative, perhaps you need to build the muscles here to get a balance. If you're naturally already this type of person, you need to balance your muscle on this side too. Actually, just on the sidetrack, there's a piece of research that's quite interesting. If you're naturally more on this side, don't check your Facebook too much. Why? There's research that suggests that people get a bit more depressed after checking Facebook. Not my words, research. I can't quote to you which one. There is a reference, but I can't remember. But you know why?
How successful other people are.
How successful other people are. And there's a four-letter word here. It starts with F. It's alright, the Buddha is here. I don't swear. FOMO. It's... It is not a detergent brand. I thought of teaching at university. How many of you have heard of FOMO? One.
Whoa.
You use that brand? Nice fragrance. FOMO means fear of missing out? FOMO. It's like a modern term that has arisen, right? And this fear of missing out is actually quite fascinating to study. Social psychologists are currently studying this phenomenon, especially with social media. When you look at Facebook, what do you usually see?
Photos.
Photos?
Yeah. Photos. Updates.
Updates? Wow, what a beautiful day. I'm on holiday right now. You're studying for an exam. You got 4 papers. You got a 3rd paper tomorrow. You got 6 revising. You check your Facebook. Then your friend posts, "Just finished last paper, yay!" And then next post, "I'm going to the beach." That's why social psychologists think that that leads to possible depression or a depressed mood, not full-blown depression, but it mucks up your mood. Because you kind of see all the things that other people have, and then you compare that with what you don't have. Because very often when you look at social media postings, it's often about good news more than bad news. That's why the default is called like. Right? My dog has died. Like, not quite, right? So it's usually more like, "I got a new puppy! Like, right? So it's more usually the language of social media is sharing great news. Right? Or a bunch of your friends hanging out together, having selfies. Right? Self photos. And you see, oh, so many friends there. How come I never get invited? Sounds like a few people could relate here. Then the FOMO starts to arise. Right? So that's why, just a side tangent, sometimes don't check Facebook too much. Anyway, coming back to more serious topic. Gratitude. Once you've got your gratitude engines moving, develop gratitude and awareness of the things that you still need to develop. Then you become a realistic or realist optimist. And this is what best places you in terms of success and happiness. Although the research shows that they may generate some level of anxiety, a bit of fear in there. Because you're more in touch, you know that it could go well or it could fail. You know that things that are well are there, you're also in touch with the things that may not be that great. So it may generate some level of anxiety. But then, third part. Combine process 1 and process 2 together. You got a synergy. You're aware of the good things, the things that still need to be worked on, and you continue working on. Then you become what we call in Buddhism, well, not really technically, a pragmatist. That's the closest approach to what the Buddha wants us to be, a pragmatist. Not a person who only focuses on what's going well, because they may not necessarily have the mind to want to improve themselves. Not the people who only focus on the negatives because they may be too depressed to move. But to be aware of the two and be willing to work on it. If you want to say what is the Buddhist approach to life, this probably summarizes it the best. You're clearly aware of what are things that are going well. You're clearly aware of the things that are not going too well, and you're continuously working on developing the things and perfecting yourself. That's why in the scriptures it says, when the practice deepens, I'm paraphrasing, but when the practice deepens, you become aware of the things that lead to unwholesome states,
and you know that those are the things to avoid, to abstain. You're fully aware of the states that lead to wholesome states, and those are the ones you continue to develop and perfect. So your eyes are on both sides of the picture. You know what are things that work, you continue to develop more. You know the things that are not working, you're abstaining, but you're taking an active approach in this. You're not just saying, oh, my life is such, full stop. There's a sense of movement. There's a sense of energy in that. And that's a pragmatist approach. I remember hearing about this in one of the retreats that I sat. And the teacher gave the story that there's a boy, and the mom actually sent this boy with an empty bottle to buy oil. He had three sons. First son went out, bicycle, went to the shops, bought a bottle of oil. $1, let's say. Don't really know how much bottle of oil costs. Let's say $1. Alright? And then boy cycles back. There's a hole, and then the bicycle goes in the hole, falls over. Half of the oil gets tipped out. The boy manages to save half of it, right? Very sadly, cycles the rest of the journey back, hands half of the bottle to the mother, and says, "Sorry, mom, I dipped or spilled half of the bottle of oil." First child. Second child. Naturally, very gleeful. Again, same case, same bottle. Cycle to the shop. Bought $1. Cycle back. And city council had no time to repair. So, fell off again. Right? Again, same thing happened. Half of the oil spilled. Quickly saved it. Happily, rode back home to the mum. Mum, there was a hole, this happened, and I managed to save half of it. Very happy, very, very joyful. Mother said, okay, great. Third day, same bottle, same bicycle, same city council issue. Some reason, the bicycle just likes the hole, or the hole likes the bicycle. Conditions come together, fell off. Half of it tipped out. Same thing, saved. Now this third child, has got some Dharma training. He's attended a few Dharma talks, has done some meditation, mental training, and then goes back and tells the mom, "Mom, this happened, I spilled out. Luckily I saved half of it, but this other half I've spilled. But don't worry, I'm going to go out, I'm going to ask for some work from the neighbors, and by the nightfall I'll earn 50 cents. I'm going to go to the shop and fill the rest of the bottle up and pray that city council has repaired." But the third approach is in fact the Buddhist approach. Because we're not just there passively accepting life or just... Both are correct. All three of them are correct. Right? Same situation, same thing happens. First one, is it correct to feel that way? Yeah, he was upset. You can't say, no, you didn't. Don't feel upset. You can't force it. But sometimes the mind is such that it's inclined towards the loss. Yeah. The second child, the mind is more inclined to what is there, the half full. But the third child is in fact in the best position because he or she is most realistic. He or she knows that what has been saved, what has been lost, not only that, he or she actually proactively seeks way of filling up that last bit. So now let me ask you, how many of you want to be a half-empty type? How many of you want to be a half-full type? How many of you want to be a pragmatic type?
Not
Yeah. Like losing a few people on the
So this is the second part of the formula. So the first part here is avoid all evil, do all good. The second part here is about gratitude, being realistic, and being a pragmatist. And there's more. What else has the Buddha given us? They say, to an optimist, this is a cup half full. To a pessimist, this is a cup half empty. To an engineer, this cup is twice the size of what is required. So,
what do you do?
We're able to make ourselves smaller. When we put down me, naturally things fill up more. When it's a lot about me, it's a lot about self-centeredness, or in psychology we call narcissism, it's all about me, then the cup becomes huge. It can't never quite feels like it's enough. And Buddhism says, soften your ego. Soften this strong sense of attachment and all about me. When you're able to do that, your this big I, me, becomes smaller and smaller. You become softer and softer. That your life is just not about you. A slight detract again. There's a fair bit of research that suggests that a certain generation, I can't remember whether it's Gen X or Gen Y. What generation is it right now anyway? There's X, Y.
Gen I.
Huh?
iPad.
Maybe Gen I is like me. But what they found is that a certain generation, I think it was end of Gen X and early Gen Y, there was a movement in education and developmental psychology that says that self-esteem is very important. Right? They have to make the children feel good about themselves. So, in the past, champion of the class won prize. Because of that, 40 kids in the class, 40 different type of prizes. Everyone is a winner. Make them feel good. You're good, you're special, you are... And that was how the education system and parenting that was encouraged. What they thought that this was useful, what they subsequently found is that when this generation actually grew up to be the center of attention and the center of like everything is good, you know, like you're the most special, most perfect being, there's a side effect. The side effect is that this particular generation becomes very self-centered. Very narcissistic. Very me oriented. And when they do that, when they face failures, they're actually not as well equipped to deal with it. Because growing up, it's like, you're the most amazing. There are a lot of us, right? You cannot be the most amazing one in all different contexts. But sometimes you may get fed unconsciously these kind of sense of, it's me, and the greatest, it's all about satisfying my needs, about my achievements. What they found is that, yeah, that created a lot of achievements, but sometimes what can happen is that you become too self-centered. relationally, you're more focused on me. If I'm friends with Alan, what can I get out of him? Right, and he's a great Buddhist practitioner, so take. But no, in the relationship, it's about me. In the workforce or anything, it's about me. In Facebook, it's about me. Wow, I woke up and brushed my teeth. I don't need to know about that. And what they found is that in terms of this particular generation growing up, the side effect is that by focusing too much on me, they're not as well equipped to deal with the realistic ups and downs in the world. So they become more upset easily. So now, the new thing that they've increased now is called, not called self-esteem, but now they're pushing self-compassion. That means you try your best, and regardless of the outcome, you're compassionate to yourself and to the situation. So that's a more realistic approach, because the self-esteem movement was more focused on this. What's good about me? So it's about focusing now, self-compassion, balancing it. But if we're able to just reduce our sense of me, it's all about me, putting it smaller and smaller, the well-being naturally increases. Now, I don't mean sacrificing yourself for other people's benefit. I don't mean that. In fact, that comes from sometimes a sense of self-aversion towards oneself. But if it's genuinely from loving, giving, caring, being interested in other people's lives, what's going on with them, that naturally brings up the real wholesomeness and well-being in your life. And that's what the kind of quality of self-compassion is. You do your best to give to yourself and to others, and you're okay with the outcome regardless. So it's in the motivation, but yet being very realistic about things. So the third training that the Buddha's teaching that I think is relevant here is reducing this big sense of me, I. And how do you do that? This is not something that you can arrive at quite easily from a conceptual point of view. This is something that takes development and practice. The most basic practice, the four immeasurables. Was there recently a talk on four immeasurables? Was it yesterday? Yeah, a Chinese Dharma talk. The four immeasurables are qualities like loving kindness, that's the first one. Second one, compassion. Third one, joy for others, or empathic joy, or sympathetic joy. And the fourth one is equanimity. This development of these four states of mind allow the me to be smaller. Because you're naturally more kind internally and externally. You're compassionate towards what's happening internally and to other people. You're able to be joyful for the goodness and things that happen in other people's life. So, you can check Facebook. But watch out for FOMO. And develop empathic joy for others. Right? So that's how you can turn things around. So it's alright. There's still hope. Don't have to chuck away your smartphone yet. But in the reprogramming and changing and development of you, it's important to develop the quality of joy for other people. It's not just about you. That selfishness or self-focusedness, the softer you can hold that, the more well-being there is. The same amount of goodness in your life multiplies when you're able to become smaller. And it's like that also in conflicts. If I have conflict with someone, I have my perspective, you have your perspective, clash. Sometimes you need to kind of put things down, right? Allow things to kind of soften. And then that allows us to see, hang on, I may have also done things that have not been very skillful. It allows that level of reflection. When you put yourself down. And then you can relate with kindness, with compassion. Doesn't mean that you become a doormat. No. But I say it's not about sacrificing your own benefit for other people. In fact, that's not the Buddha's view. The Buddha's view is that you develop yourself so well and you become so strong that regardless of what happens with other people, you are still all right. And how do you achieve that? By becoming smaller. And when you're becoming smaller, you're also a smaller target. You know the saying that people push your buttons? If you're bigger, they're just more buttons, right? But if you're bigger, you're like a moving target. Shoot me, right? But if I'm a small target, it's quite difficult too. Right? And that's to do with the Buddhist trainings of the mind. The training of the four immeasurables. That you're able to develop loving kindness, compassion, empathic joy, and equanimity. There is more. They're like, wow, this talk is going on and on. Good value. Alright? That's one last piece. What do you think it is?
There is no karma.
Really?
Really?
At the end of the day, there is no cup. Why is this funny? When your practice deepens, in particularly with meditation, with insight meditation, you observe the reality of nature. You observe what this whole construct about me is. You pay attention to the moment-to-moment experiences that unfold. The physical body, the feelings that come and go, the thoughts that come and go, the different phenomena that comes and goes. And you recognize that things happen because of different conditions that come together, things arise. When the conditions fall away, things fall away. Right, you start to tap into the nature of change. Things keep shifting. Right? What's this whole big sense of me that I'm holding so strongly on? You start to see that actually it's just conditions. Things come together, things arise. Things drop off, things fall away. You start to tap into the fact that things keep changing according to whatever input that is there. In fact, this strong sense of me, I, that we so dearly hold on to. In fact, when you really look deeply in it, there's no one there. There's no one at home. This is the part that is quite difficult to conceptually understand. And that's why it's not often spoken about. This is the teaching of non-self, teaching of the three marks of existence. That because of not recognizing the nature that things shift, things change internally and externally. We hold on to the fact that things have to be a certain way, things have to be permanent. We hold on to this strong sense of me that keeps flux changing anyway. Every cell in our body is different from 3 months ago, 3 years ago, 30 years ago. Every thought, every emotion, every experience that we have has come up and has gone, has shifted. There's really no a strong sense of this strong me throughout. It does seem, it appears to be that that's the case. But in deep reality, when you actually see it and perceive that, in meditation, this is what we call the arising of wisdom, the arising of insight. Then it starts to create such a transformation in your life that, you know, you let loose a lot of things. And that's what the Buddha has achieved. Without anyone's guidance, he was observing the internal realities of what's coming up. Why suffering arises? What leads to it? How does it fall away? What are the different conditions for different things that arise fall away? And then he realizes that there's no sense of a creator. Things come together because of conditions. Things fall away because of conditions. You start to see deeply and deeply the nature that things change, things shift. That this whole sense of me, Chen Hong, Alan, Emily, Rosie, for fun, they're all created. For conventional, yes, conventionally as we relate, but is there at the heart of it really that strong concept that we invest so much of our life force in
in preserving a certain image, a certain permanent that's there. And this is hard to understand. You can kind of get it conceptually to a certain degree, but it's still hard to grasp until through experience you look at your life over and over again, how things shift. That's how wisdom arises. And when it arises, it erodes and it erodes, it softens the sense of me, and eventually it just shatters the entire sense of me. And that's the Buddha's achievement. Does it mean that he kind of zones out and kind of explodes in a mushroom cloud? No. When we say the Buddha gained enlightenment, it's enlightenment to the realities of self. And then he taught us, you know, what are the things that lead to more happiness? What are the things that lead to more suffering? And invited us to see for ourselves what this nature of reality is about. And whether there's this strong sense of me that is there. And when that happens, this breaks away. And everything becomes abundance. There's water everywhere. And this is the most profound part, which is captured in wisdom, dependent origination, conditionality, impermanence, non-self, the breaking free and liberation from suffering. But that's for another day. But what I wanted to give you is a full picture of 9 different paths. This happened to be nice. From the most basic part of where we can start developing to become better. Really, this question is about how can we continue to develop ourselves so that we can live a life that is better, that has greater sense of steadiness, a greater sense of peace, lightness, and they were able to move through the ups and downs of life much better. And this comes from laying the most basic framework of avoiding evil, the precepts that we have. It's about doing the good things that we have in our life. Being able to do the things that nourish us, that's good for us, and doing things that bring benefit to other people. Do all good. Take wholesome actions. And when we are there, we are in the process of developing and building this cup and whatever we have. Avoid all evil and do good. It is about when we are at a certain point in our lives, being able to look at the things that are going right through gratitude. Because it propels us, it supports us, it motivates us, it inspires us. It stirs us deeply. But it's not just that. It's about keeping both eyes open to see what is going well and also being open to see the reality of the things that still need to work on. We are all work in progress. We are all work in progress. It is okay that we have parts that are not filled yet. Until we come to the realization that there are things that are going well and there are things that are still need to be improved, then we can take a pragmatist approach. We know what is there and what to continue building. Then we deepen our practice that way. To avoid all evil, to do good, to have gratitude, to be realistic about things, and to take a pragmatic approach here. And then we take it even further. When you're ready to go even deeper into the practice, then through the practice of meditation, cultivating awareness, cultivating insight, cultivating the good qualities of the mind, loving kindness, compassion, empathic joy, equanimity, and continue deepening into the reality of the mind, reality of what this self is about, ultimately breaking free from this sense of me, 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 me. And then your life becomes open. Your life becomes free. There's no more target. You can't even find a target to shoot at anymore. And this is when the Buddha says that what needs to be accomplished has been accomplished. What needs to be done has been done. The holy life has been lived, and the mind is at full liberation. But you need to start from here. You may try to jump, but then take it step by step.
So this is the entire part of how to be.
Dot, dot, dot. Is that all right, Emily? Was that what you expected?
Of course, I may email later. All right. We still have some time. Questions?
Two possibilities. One is that the material is so good that there's no doubt. The other one is people have all fallen asleep. Sorry for fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Just wanted to ask, like, how does meditation
actually
help us in the third part in smaller? The cup, shrinking the cup.
Making it smaller?
Yeah. And how does meditation actually help us to see it?
Yeah. That this is a greater different level to it. Right? Initially when you practice meditation, what it allows you to do is to untangle from things. Right? You've got strong emotions that come out, strong states that come out, anger or whatever it is, it latches on the mind and it pulls you. With meditation, you're able to see that and it dislodges it, it softens it. There's almost you used to be very sticky, and through meditation, you develop like a Teflon coating. Right? The life throws shit at you, it doesn't stick as much. Still probably kind of near you and still kind of a bit of stain, but it's a bit more Teflon-ish. Okay, that's like the first part. Right? But depending on what type of meditation practice you do, you're able to just kind of step back or dislodge things. And you're able to see that, and as your practice deepens, you know that the more that you hold on to things, the more painful it becomes. And when the more you hold on to, like, it's me, it's like, it's all about me, what he or she did wrong to me, about my views and things like that. You notice for yourself, and don't take the Buddha's word for it, don't take my word for it, you notice that the stronger that you hold on to things, the more painful it becomes. You see it for yourself. It's not from textbook, it's not because the teacher says so. You see through your own practice, as you hold on, you grasp, that becomes more painful. And we're able to soften, right? Then there's more peace that naturally arises. Then you start to know what are conditions that contribute to happiness, peacefulness, what are conditions that contribute to distress, more suffering and pain. It becomes clearer to you what's what. And then, as the practice deepens, you start to see that this whole me, is it really that important? It is important for functional reasons, but is it so important that we invest our entire life force in maintaining? And like I say, this is not kind of a conceptual thing, it's kind of seeing it for yourself. That it becomes that, well, perhaps it's not just about this, there's something else. Right? So it keeps on softening, it keeps on becoming smaller until it dissolves away. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Best way to know? Find out.
Practice. Check it out for yourself. Yep.
You see number 3?
Yep.
You've got a big Vika or cup with water. Mm-hmm. And the second leading to it is the smaller Vika, smaller cup. With
yep.
Full water. And the third one is no cup, but where the water gone?
Everywhere. Okay, just to help you.
Because there's no sense of that. The normal reference points that we see and we measure one's well-being, that's kind of, that's not relevant anymore. There's something much deeper, tapping into much deeper. And to be honest, I've not personally experienced this, so it's hard for me to say still. This process I'm quite familiar with, but this process has only started. Right? But it's the process of gradually softening, seeing reality, and then it becomes, there's something else that opens up. Sometimes people say, know me, then what? Know me, then everything.
Find out. Does that answer your question? Other questions?
How can we deal with careers that require you to be constantly motivated? Like, they always want you to be hungry and always chase for stuff. Like, sometimes it's like very contradictory.
I won't cheat.
See what Tina says next week. But when we live in this world, right, and when our practice is at a certain level, we try our best. It's always like that. Right? And some teachers say that as you're practicing, sometimes you have to pretend in the real world too. You kind of have to pretend that. But there is opportunity for practice at each point. When you know that there are certain targets you have to hit, there are certain ways that you have to be in a workplace, right? It's about a mind shift away. That means doing your work from what type of intention, what mindset are you coming from, what intention you're putting. A same, exact same work can appear very differently to different people. I've got different friends, and some of them are in sales. And some of them sell insurance policies, right? And there are friends who sell it purely to make money. They sell the product, they do very well, fine. Does the product help? Yeah. Times of difficulty, you got insurance. But there are also other friends who sell from the heart. They're still selling the exact same thing, going through the exact same process, but the mind that they bring to it is that may you have security. Right? May you have support in times of need. And that's their practice. So it depends on how we weave that into our work life. So that's one. The other thing is, sometimes in certain work areas, the values may clash a lot, and which makes it difficult. And in times like that, it is also a time of reflection for us. What are the things that it's clashing with? It's a good opportunity, like a mirror, for us to know what is consistent with what we believe and what ethical standpoint we want to be. What are the things that clash? It's a good mirror for us. And sometimes when it's really that difficult, it's useful to consider change. That becomes more supportive for our well-being and for the well-being of others. So certain work that may be useful, you can still have some flexibility in it. Bring the best mindset to it. I'm a psychologist. And if I think that, oh, this particular client coming to see me, oh, how much can I earn from them? How many sessions? Oh, a lot of difficulties. Very good, very good. Long-term therapy. Very good, very good. How much per session? Well, even better. Oh, this is a student. Have to give concession rate. Hi-yo. What am I practicing? Right? And sometimes the environment gets us in that. And that's why we have to have our both eyes open. And be clear of what's actually happening. No. Right? And within those type of environment, you can shift. What are the things that you pay attention to? And in fact, when I'm able to work the best for my clients, the rest starts to flow much naturally. I feel more at ease also. So there's no real straight answer to that question, to be honest. But I suspect that most of our work, there is some level of change in perspective that we can already have. If you're wanting to invest your life in a certain work is going to be a large number of hours of your life. is probably the next highest from sleep. You agree? So you have to actually think of what type of work that you want to commit. Because you'll be practicing certain type of mind frames, mindsets, certain type of habits of the mind. So that is important. Because you get a lot of opportunity to practice from your work. But don't necessarily shy away from it, that's fine. Sometimes you have to outwardly pretend, to be honest. For me, I don't need to. Right? But certain work you have to. But that is coming from what you're drawing from within. And as your practice continues to develop, it becomes easier to make choices too. You know what is more conducive and what is not. Remember I was saying that the Buddha was saying that whatever is good, you know, to develop and perfect. Whatever is not good and not wholesome, you naturally know to abstain and to let go. That wisdom becomes easier. Then the ethical choices that we make becomes clearer and clearer. Ask Tina. Next week. Does that kind of give you some things to think about? But very good question. Free consultation. Question? Is this useful? Think about. You go home, it's like, my friend say, oh, how was the Dharma talk? I don't know, there's just a lot of cups. There are like 8 cups and don't know what happened last one. Buddhism is a gradual path. Okay, it's a path that is systematic, it's structured, it's step by step. And it's useful to just kind of take it in the pace that is suitable for you. But we're not all expected to grow at the same level, at the same point. But the main thing is that you need to develop yourself, develop your mind, develop your life, so that your life becomes much steadier. Because when we are much better in ourselves, we also relate much better. I spoke about this the last time I came here last year. When we are not in a great shape, other people know, they feel it too. When we are stressed, we are grumpy. Right? The people around you, like, right? There's a sense of, whoa, let's not get too close. So our practice is not just for us. Practice is for everyone around us. Right? It's about developing, growing, developing, growing. The Buddha challenged us, and the tradition was bhavana. Bhavana is the word that's in modern day, we all talk about meditation. There's no such a word in Buddhism. There's no equivalent word of meditation in Buddhism, in the traditional scriptures. There is a word, however, that comes the closest, which is bhavana. Bhavana is an ancient Pali word. It actually means the cultivation. So when we talk about Buddhist practices, it's about bhavana. It's about the cultivation of our mind. So this is an invitation for us to cultivate at different levels as we are ready. And you are going to do this, and then sometimes you fall back, and then it's fine, you continue on. But eventually, as you grow, it becomes easier. It becomes part of your life. How you are, how you interface, how you are with other people. And each step of the way we learn. We're given more tools by the Buddha, right? And we become more in touch with what is really there. And that's the Buddha's invitation to us. Come and see. Right? He didn't say come and believe, come and do, come and meditate. Very often universe has come and join us or something. Not tonight. But he didn't say those things. He says come and see. Ehi pasiko. To come and make contact and check it out. Because his invitation is for us to see what is reality. Because when we know what reality is, what's the next step becomes much easier. That's just how it works. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
I have some cards, business cards, if you want to stay in touch.
Concession.